And now it's time for wait a minute. What the hell is the show called again?
It's Chatter on Books. What else do you want me to say? Can I go now?
That's right. It's Chatter on Books. Let's do this thing.
Okay, we are back. Welcome back to Chatter on Books. This is our 37th episode. We got to do something special for 40 just because it seems like a big number. And Jamie McIntyre is here. Weren't you with us for the first show?
He was.
I believe so.
Didn't you say something about it was going to be a trivia question?
I put that on my resume when people, you know, achievements, along with my badges.
First and maybe 15th and now 40th. Welcome back. So we are back. We're at our favorite undisclosed location, and Jeannie McManus is here, and Roberta's here. We might put her on the mic. Marcellus is doing everything important. We have Ed Eimar, who is going to talk to us about all sorts of interesting things, and his wonderful book, The Unrepentant, which, Jeannie, I think safe to say, scared you. I loved it.
I had bad nightmares about that book.
But well, because
you look like such a nice man, Ed. It's kind of hard for me to...
We're wondering where that comes from. The dark side comes from. But we got, what do we have on tap? We have some random thoughts. We're going to have a little bit of a debate, I think, about Edward Snowden's new book. I don't think anybody should have published it. I don't think anybody should read it. We're going to have Ed talking about all sorts of crime and dark stuff. And on Deserted Island, we're going to take a little turn and try to match books with cocktails. First up, Wine and Cheese from Calvert Woodley. God bless Michael Sands. I'm operating, let's say, walking wounded today, and Michael Sands brought over tonight's Wine and Cheese, which is very nice of him. And Jeannie, you have to comment, because I think you're drinking it. Jamie, you're drinking it too?
I am.
Yeah, it's a French Chardonnay, which is lovely.
Les Charmes? Is that how I would say
and
that?
Not, yes, I think
sure.
So. And not oaky at all. Very light. Roberta, would you agree with me about that?
Okay, Roberta agrees. Fresh citrus aromas lead to a creamy palate and an elegant fruity finish. People get paid a lot of money
Roberta
to write
and I
these
just
descriptions.
Said the exact same thing
on the back.
Money.
And Jamie.
We get that generic, refreshing white that comes in the big box.
Yes.
This is a definite step.
Have you had wine in a can yet?
No, but we're all supposed to start switching to cans.
Yes.
Because the aluminum cans are the only things that are really totally recyclable.
And our friends at Calvert Woodley at 4339 Connecticut Avenue, our sponsor, everyone should go there, are now selling it in the can. So I thought if they're selling it, it must be okay. And I got some. And I'm not a big wine drinker, but I drink enough. And whatever I had, some Sauvignon Blanc, was quite good, actually. So I have to be careful, though, because when I put a can in my hand, you know, it's flashbacks to high school and it's in Iron City, and I'm like, shoot. Throw the sucker back. Well, there are several glasses of wine in there, so you have to be careful.
So this wine has a screw top, which look down on, but actually,
right?
Again, it absolutely no effect on the flavor of the wine, and it's much more responsible than to put corks or even plastic corks in your wine bottle.
When I was
I'm going to drink a toast to that.
There you go. So you're closer to the cheese. Mm-hmm. La Cheeserie gave us some nice cheese. I couldn't tell much from the label. German Rouget. What's it like, Jamie?
Well, you can see that
big hunk taken out of it.
That one wedge of cheese that was.
We're kind of lucky Michael's not here because he usually inhales the cheese. Yeah,
it's delightful.
Good,
and it's lactose free, right?
Gluten free, I think too.
How can cheese be?
I have no idea.
Have to ask.
Isn't that what it said?
That says on that. Brian, our bartender is here. How can cheese be lactose free?
It shouldn't be.
It shouldn't be. Okay.
Okay, but we're very grateful.
But that's not a comment on our sponsor,
the cheese. Yes,
Calvert Woodley at 4339 Connecticut Avenue. If you go there and say Chatter 5 at the checkout, and they now know this, and I tried it the other day, you get $5 off, which is not nothing.
What's the point of cheese?
I don't know. Okay, so on to Edward Snowden and Jamie. I'm glad you're here on a couple of our topics tonight. Remind us who Edward Snowden wished he had been.
Edward Snowden was an NSA contractor. And by contractor, I mean basically he was an employee because you may know.
Very young.
Very
it was
young.
Early 20s.
Served in the Army. He had he looked like he was going to be picked for special forces, but he ended up having an injury. Came from an interesting family. His parents were sort of what we would refer to now as civil servants.
Mm-hmm.
His mom was a clerk at the NSA. He was very into computers, and once he sort of had to leave the Army, he got involved in computers, and he was... he had access, you know, and this is a lesson for everybody in security. The IT guys everywhere. They have access to everything.
That's right.
He had a very high top secret clearance, and he's the one that he ended up leaking. It's a long story, but basically he found some journalists that he wanted to work with. He ended up with talking to Glenn Greenwald of The Intercept and leaking sensitive classified information, which revealed that the United States government was doing more than just sort of passive surveillance, but was collecting a large amount of phone metadata in their effort to track who was contacting terrorists. And this created a lot of outrage. And so the big debate about Edward Snowden is he a whistleblower? Is he a patriot? Is he a traitor?
He's been living in Russia.
He's been
because he
went to Russia hoping he was going to go to a third country.
Venezuela.
And he got stuck there. He was separated from his girlfriend, who he's since reunited with and married and living in Russia. But he's stuck now living in Russia because he can't come back because he faces prosecution under the Espionage Act. This was 6 years now. And to me, the funny thing about it is the thing that he revealed in his role as a whistleblower, and you can't see this because we're not on visual, but I'm making
News Channel 8 can see.
With my fingers.
Yeah.
It almost seems kind of passé now, given all the information that we all give up every day now of our exact location. I made a wrong turn coming here tonight and had to activate my Google Maps app, which knows where I am all the time.
Yep.
Knows at my location, knows all kinds of things about me, and so it almost seems kind of quaint, the things that we were worried about. But it did create a big outrage in 2013, 2014, when it was revealed that the extent of this surveillance was much greater than people knew and actually greater than the Congress had authorized.
And he leaked classified information, which I go way hard over on this, because while there are plenty of problems with classified information, the government classifies way too much information. And that has a way of cheapening the brand and lessening the import of it. And I could go on about that for hours. But when you sign up for jobs like the ones Edward Snowden had, you sign very serious looking pieces of paper saying, I will not leak this information to people who aren't authorized to have this information. So whether you agree or disagree with the law or the seriousness of what he leaked, he broke the law. He absolutely broke the law. So then when I see, in this case, it's Macmillan, the book is called Permanent Record, I see somebody publishing it. I'm assuming they gave him some kind of advance. I'm assuming he's going to make some kind of money for this. I hate that. I absolutely hate that. Jeannie?
The government is coming after him in a civil suit, requiring that the proceeds of this book go back to them for this violation. He violated a contract that he signed to...
Right, signs NDAs.
Right.
Which people can understand.
However, I mean, does he have every right to publish it? Does Macmillan have every right to publish it? Yes. Do we have to read it?
Does Macmillan have the right to publish? Again, I don't even... Jamie would know better than I do because I'm getting fuzzy on this stuff. But is the information he leaked, is some of it still classified? And he may not be putting any of it in the book.
It's not in the book.
The book's a memoir,
I've
right?
Have
you?
Book.
God bless Jeannie. Again, back to books.
So this reminds me of a conversation I heard between an anchor and somebody on CNN the other day. Someone was trashing the Mueller report, and then the anchor said, well, have you read the report?
It's great.
And, not mentioning any names.
Yeah.
And he actually said, no, I haven't read it. So I haven't read the book. I did read an excerpt of it. It's a very interesting book. You can tell that Edward Snowden is a very bright and even thoughtful person, even if you totally disagree with what he did and how he did it. I think the First Amendment should protect this kind of thing, as long as he's not disclosing more classified information. The problem I had with Edward Snowden is that, so he took this information, he contacted journalists who supposedly vetted the information and withheld some of it. As a journalist, I'm not sure I totally trust journalists to know what is okay to release and what isn't. But it's a lot different from, say, Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, who just dumps everything out there with no thought at all. Or even Chelsea, formerly Bradley Manning, who also just took a big bunch of stuff and just threw it out there. Snowden had a reason. He thought he was doing the right thing. Little different from, say, the Pentagon Papers case, where Daniel Ellsberg did not flee to Russia, but stuck around to stand trial when he released stuff he wasn't supposed to release. Mm-hmm. But the big point that I keep coming back to, that seems it's really interesting to me, this case that's going on now with this whistleblower in the intelligence community having made.
Right.
So the big criticism against Edward Snowden is he didn't follow the procedures. If you think there's something wrong, you're supposed to report it through channels.
Right.
You're supposed to be protected as a whistleblower.
Which this whistleblower is doing.
And he's being trashed for doing it. And if it's the case that you can't rely on the system to make a complaint, have it investigated, transmitted to the Intelligence Committee as the law requires, mm-hmm. then we're going to have more Edward Snowdens.
Yeah. Yep. Did you like the book, Jeannie? It's a memoir, right?
It's a memoir.
And by the way, nobody under 85 should write a memoir.
I agree with Jamie that he's very smart. He's articulate writer. If you were a 30 or 40 year old tech guy, you would love this book, because Snowden talks about how he was early on into computers and was into the internet. And he describes this, and it struck me as something I never thought about. At one point, the internet was one world and reality was the other world. And then those two worlds fused because commerce and retail entered the internet.
Completely intertwined.
And so it wasn't just you and your fellow techies. Mm-hmm. Gaming, figuring out codes to how to beat other people at games. It became, where do I buy shoes? And mm-hmm. you're buying shoes in your credit card, and all of a sudden now the real world is intervening in the internet. And so if you were of that age, this would be fascinating to see his evolution. Mm-hmm. But for me, it holds no interest, and really there's a lot of self-aggrandizing and revisionism, mm-hmm. which is troublesome to me. I nevertheless think he obviously has the right to publish.
So, you know, as a parent, you look at this and you think, okay, so what about my 20-year-old son? And one of the things that's really revealing about the book is this thought process of how he sort of comes to what it is he thinks he ought to be doing. There's an interesting anecdote where he figures out. So one of the things about hacking is figuring out how to get around the system. And he figures out when he's in school, he's bristling at the amount of homework, and he figures out
right.
he doesn't do the homework. If he just does okay on the quizzes, he'll pass the class, right. and that's good enough for him. And when the teacher confronts him and says, you know, like, why aren't you doing your homework? He explains, well, all you need to do is do the quizzes. So I don't need to do the homework. And he says, well, you know, that's very clever, but you ought to think about using your brain and to get as much information as you can. And he says, you know, and this is going to go on your permanent record, which is the name of the book.
Right.
Permanent record. It's, you know, I think it's an interesting read. I think he's got every reason to every right to write it. I actually think it's a worthwhile read if you want to understand everything in context, which is kind of what journalism is all mm-hmm. about.
I don't know. He wouldn't be writing the book. We wouldn't be having this conversation if he hadn't broken the law, and a really serious law with really big impacts. Yeah, we absolutely would. Any one of us who goes on Amazon and buys, you know, Dogfish IPA beer, then we get 18,000 ads. And when I walk into Calvert Woodley, go, oh, Tori, you want your...
No,
we knew this. Yeah, I think smart people knew.
About serial killers, written by serial killers.
Well, those are interesting.
People watch movies about Ted Bundy. I mean, there's no understanding.
I guess.
You know.
Okay. All right. Well, you're wrong. I'm right. my show.
You give in.
Okay. No. But it's a good, I think, interesting segue, something Jeannie and I were kicking around earlier today. Lots in the news these days about factual errors in books, which the publishing industry, for different reasons, didn't catch, and then bigger implications because the reporting world takes it even further. So, Jeannie, how do you feel about this? As someone who had reporters come to you, I don't want to put words in, but you had reporters come to you with stories, and in the story, they would take something from a book.
Right.
But they would take it as fact, correct?
Right.
So, go ahead.
This was not common, but it happened several times when I was an editor at the Washington Post, that someone would write something and there'd be a red flag in it. And I would say, well, where does this come from? Well, it came from a book by so-and-so. And there was one reporter who was particularly prone to returning to books as a source. Well, there are different standards for different kinds of publications. I don't know what particular publishing houses have what particular standards, but I knew what my particular standards were at the Washington Post, and I'm not holding up the Washington Post as the be-all and the end-all of standards. But when I got something like that, I started from ground zero, and I worked my way up. And one reporter kept insisting, well, so-and-so has this in the book. Well, so-and-so, to me, was not a credible author. Mm-hmm. And this reporter kept persisting, and I went to the lawyers at the Post who said, no way you're putting this in that story. And I said, no way we're putting this in that story.
Police racing down the mean streets
arrest me for
the undisclosed location
activity. And the reporter insisted, and I said, okay, like, you can insist, and I'll go up to Mrs. Graham and say, Mrs. Graham, open your checkbook, because when we run this story tomorrow, you're going to be writing a big settlement check because of this guy. And so I think what brings this to mind is an article that I read this weekend in the New York Times. Mistakes are embarrassing the publishing industry. And
I think that headline's a little incomplete.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's more than embarrassing, but there are varying standards of accountability with authors and publishers about who's responsible for the facts. In many cases, it's the authors, and the publishers are not taking on that responsibility. Mm-hmm. And some authors do take it on, and some authors do not.
Yeah, as you and I talked, I wrote a stupid book in 2006, Lipstick on the Pig, still available in China for $2.99. On Alibaba. You can get it there. And I remember paying somebody at the time, and all mine was just, you know, stupid little communication stories. And I remember hiring somebody, paying somebody money out of my pocket to fact check. And whenever somebody was mentioned in a story that I told, I sent it to them. I sent it to three or four other people, make sure I get their recollection. And then on top of that, Simon & Schuster, which published the book, my dreadful editor, Dominic Anfuso, they had several lawyers fact-checking everything, and it was nothing important and nothing anybody be. But I wonder if with the time and economy, publishers just aren't putting as much money into it. But then remind me of the Malcolm Gladwell anecdote. Malcolm Gladwell, who we consider as God, Malcolm Gladwell throws out in one of his books that poets had the highest suicide rate, right?
Yeah.
And somebody saw that and said, that doesn't seem right. And then it turns out it was a study of poets in a very limited geographical area in 18-something or other.
Well, Andrew Ferguson, a writer for The Atlantic, took that on and discovered that the paper that Gladwell cited was a 1993 book by Kay Redfield Jameson, a very good writer, a psychologist, who based the findings on suicides among 36 major British and Irish poets born between 1705 and 1805.
Yeah.
So that's obviously a very limited sample. But I would say this story, which was an excellent and thought-provoking story, didn't then ask Malcolm Gladwell.
Excellent point.
Comments.
I thought the same thing. Yeah. And then the most glaring one that we've all heard about in the last week or so, the New York Times is reporting on allegations about Kavanaugh, and they based it on the book written by two women, and they didn't do any fact-checking on their story, and then we find out that this particular allegation, the woman herself declined to be interviewed.
No, they did fact-checking. And but, in the book, they mentioned the woman's name.
But in the reporting of the book, they didn't.
Yeah, so that
Yeah.
That was an editing decision. So, this is...
Right, but that's what I'm saying. This headline of this story is, it's a fact, mistakes are embarrassing the publishing industry. These mistakes are embarrassing the media industry.
The mistake wasn't a mistake. In fact, it was a mistake to not include the information. And it shows you how sometimes with the best intentions you can make mistakes. So the Times has a policy that they don't identify people who, if they don't want to be identified, who are the victims of sexual assault and misconduct. So when the two writers wrote the story based on the book, they included the fact that the woman, according to her friends, she hasn't talked to anybody, mm-hmm. according to her friends, doesn't remember the incident. And so doesn't know that it actually took place, which is a very important point to include. It was in the original story, but apparently the New York Times editors took it out because they weren't identifying the woman, and they thought this was some sort of it was clearly an editing mistake.
Except that whether I'm writing that story for the book or for the New York Times, I am not putting in an incident where the alleged victim won't talk to me, and friends of the alleged victim have said she doesn't recall the incident, and there's no supporting evidence.
Well, there's a named source.
There's one
eyewitness.
There's one named source. That would not be sufficient for me to include either in my book or in the excerpted article.
Mm-hmm. I find it fascinating. Kind of fascinating.
Well, so, but books are full of all kinds of errors, and one of the problems. So, when you're online, you can correct the error, and often you see the original version. Say there'll be a footnote. Yeah. The original version of the story had these embarrassing mistakes in it, but we cleaned them out.
But the New York Times clearly did, well, one, they didn't like all the attention that brought to them, and they felt badly about it. I noticed in the Sunday book section of the New York Times, where they have the bestsellers list and everything else, drives me crazy, but I look at it because Jeannie says I should, and there's just this little tiny box in the corner. Oh, in last week's story about such and such, I remember the name of the book. We declined to include this information, and they just, it's front page news. It was top of the news and evening news.
On the actual story, I thought they did.
They did.
This reminds me, though, when I was in the Pentagon one day, I think, Tori, when you were in the Pentagon, and Tom Shanker, who was a reporter for the New York Times, was in the hallway, and he was being berated by some general, who I won't name, about the New York Times, and he said, the New York Times, he said, is the most inaccurate news organization of all. And Tom, who being defensive, was saying, how can you possibly say that? We try very hard to get everything right. And he said, there are more corrections in the New York Times than any other paper.
They're more honest.
That's great.
And the point is, of course, that there are many, many mistakes made. If you're a media critic, you have no shortage of material to work with. But the important thing is that when a mistake is made, that it's acknowledged, that it's corrected, and it's corrected in sort of the same high profile that the original.
Yeah, well, but Jamie, high profile will be the front page, top half of the fold.
I think
that does not often happen.
About this mistake,
yeah.
And what it was, and what the actual facts were,
yeah.
If you're paying attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, before we take a break, I do have to say today is he died in 1939. Freud died on this day in 1939. So his first book, Interpretation of Dreams, which became the be all end all, they originally published 600 copies, only 600 copies, and it took 8 years to sell. So, those of you out there listening who are having trouble getting your book sold, just
write
wait.
About your dreams.
I'm not
tell
good
us.
At math, but I'm doing the math per year, and I'm coming. On your iPad.
Really, I knew something about him. I didn't know a lot about him, though. I knew he's a chain smoker. I knew he died of cancer. Had something like 30 operations.
Liked cocaine.
Loved cocaine. Know about that.
So the moral of the story is, you can be successful even if your book doesn't sell.
Yeah, well, they eventually sold. And then he sold many, 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 many more once he became famous. My dad, 97, who, as Jeannie knows, was reading the Encyclopedia Britannica. And Jeannie, the bad news is he's up to about Y.
Oh, dear.
We think when he hits Z, it's...
The clock is ticking.
That's it. The clock's ticking. So he was an ear, nose, and throat surgeon in World War II, end of World War II, in the Pacific. And the anesthetic they used then was pure raw cocaine. Mm-hmm. And first, being the idiot that he was, he didn't understand why his patients kept coming back. People punching themselves in the face and that. And then, as he likes to say, being the man of science that he was, he needed to understand what was it that made his patients like this so much. So he tried a little. 60 years after doing it, his face lights up, and there is rapture for him talking about the effects of cocaine. He claims it was his first and last experience. Okay, Marcellus, we're going to take a break, come back with Ed, and talk about all sorts of things dark and crime and murder, which I just love. It's Chatter on Books, and we're back with Ed. I'm just going to read some titles here, Ed. The Unrepentant, The Night of the Flood, I'll Sleep When You Are Dead, You're As Good As Dead. So welcome, and have you always been this cheerful and uplifting? Has this been your whole life?
Yeah, thank you for having me here. The I'll Sleep When You're Dead and You're As Good As Dead are going to be followed by It's Just Dead, 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 Dead. I'm trying to continue a theme.
Good. It's working.
Thank you.
Excellent. T-shirts.
Good to have a theme.
Yeah. So you write, you host salons, as I think is the only word I can think of, on crime and mystery. You mentor a lot, people who want to write.
Right.
What's your particular attraction with this darker side of life? How did you get to this place? When you were five, did you say, I want to write murder mysteries?
I didn't. I actually was... So my folks had a really open approach to me reading. They were fine with me reading or listening or watching anything at all. So naturally, I gravitated towards the darkest stuff. And I think...
Naturally? I read Mad Magazine and watched The Beverly Hillbillies. So, just saying.
I have a five-year-old. Uh-huh. And I was having lunch with a friend this weekend, and she was telling me about her kid who's eight, and she's like, you know, what you don't realize is that you get these pictures of kids is that they're empathetic and caring and, you know, they're cheerful. They're little serial killers.
Yeah.
Most of their upbringing is you telling them, and this is her saying this, you know, please don't kill, you know, just.
Yeah. No, they're born animals, and we try to
don't
get it out of them.
Don't smash that firefly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, my son, we had four pets, and we had a rabbit.
Past tense?
We did, because our rabbit passed away, and my wife and I were explaining it to our son earlier this year, and he said, so we're at three. And I was like, right, well, yeah, four. We had four, but now we're at three. And mm-hmm. He's like, okay, so then we'll be down to two soon. And I was like, well, what do you know? And how did our rabbit die?
You didn't tell him that the rabbit went to live at a farm someplace, because that's what they would always tell me.
No. I said she seized up and blood and feces spewed from her, which I thought was appropriate. You don't want to shield.
Teach them young. Yeah, absolutely. What did you want to be when you were five?
I wanted to be a Navy SEAL. That was my dream until high school. And my dad, who was in the military, said, you know, one thing with Navy SEALs is they have to sometimes kill people.
Yeah.
I was like, what? I thought
they saved people.
I thought it was obstacle courses and, you know, some kind of chant, maybe. I didn't know that it would be anything. And a lot of swimming and scuba diving. G.I. Joe, which I was a fan of, there's not, you know, the killing's relatively bloodless.
Yeah.
Which is sort of why I write, why I think I write the type of violence I do, which sounds like a poor way to sell a book by saying it's really violent.
But it's really violent.
But I think it does a disservice to an extent the way we view violence. And that's not necessarily a novel point of view. I'm a big fan of violent movies. I've seen...
Such as?
I've seen Avengers Endgame maybe, you know, 15, 20 times. I work out to Avengers.
Good for you. Marcellus gives that a big thumbs up.
Thank you. But, you know, it's a bloodless movie in a lot of ways. You know, Indiana Jones, same thing. The people, lots of people die.
Well, some faces melt.
Some faces melt, but they had a cost.
Yeah, yeah.
I find that distressing. I want violence to be... To feel real, to feel as ugly as it is. I mean, when you view violence the way I do, which is that it's an ugly, maybe a necessary act, but an ugly and scarring one, then there's really no other way to present it.
my God, there's so many questions I could ask. Most of them come to stuff that I've binge watched on TV, but this is about books. So were there authors that were role models for you? Because I say this as a compliment. When I read The Unrepentant, I thought, God, this is like Elmore Leonard, which I love. Yeah, and I really do. But were there authors that were role models for you? Not Freud, because he didn't sell a thing.
No, the loser. I really, you know, when I was in high school, I was reading, I got introduced to David Morrell, who wrote Rambo and Heart of the Rose and some others. And he was the first thriller author I ever read. And I had the chance to meet him last year. We work for the same organization, the International Thriller Writers. And I told him, you know, you were my favorite writer in high school. And I thought he'd be excited, but he just seemed sort of deflated. And he was like, well, how old are you? And I was like, oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize.
Talk about international thriller writers and noir at the bar.
Okay, so
you're a very busy man.
Yeah, noir at the bar sounds interesting to me.
Yeah. It's fun. Yeah, I'll talk about that first, because there's one coming up on October 12th, and we have them at the Wonderland Ballroom in D.C., which is on Kenyon Street, near, if not in, it's very close to Columbia Heights. And so it's 8 to 10 crime fiction writers, and they typically crime fiction, but we've had poets, romance writers, science fiction writers, and they read short stories, 8 to 10 minutes each, so they're not too long. It's at a bar, usually in a private room, and everybody's drinking. The stories don't necessarily have to be noir, but they follow that sort of approach. They're usually pretty darkly funny, humorous, the kind of, you know, I can't believe I'm laughing at this sort of thing. And we're doing our 10th one, and we've had everybody, like I mentioned, you know, writers from other genres, but we'll have Jim Grady, who wrote 6 Days of the Condor.
Oh, yeah. It's
a great book. A constant presence. Great book. He'll be at this one. We'll have Kathleen Barber, who her book, Are You Sleeping, is being made a TV show produced by Reese Witherspoon, coming out in December. So there's, everybody.
How do you define noir? Don't say French for black, Jamie. I know it's about which I could see it on your face.
Chinatown.
Yeah.
I think of noir as being, you know, to use the term unrepentant, dark, usually with unredeemable characters who are on the seedier side of life. I think those are the typical things that I see when I read either classic or contemporary noir.
You mentioned, you know, the authors that influence you. So growing up and going to the University of Florida and living in Florida, I was
influenced
by John D. MacDonald and Travis McGee. And now, more recently, I'm kind of a Lee Child, Jack Reacher, which I kind of see as almost an updated version of Travis McGee. Tell me a little bit about The Unrepentant. Why would it appeal to someone like me? Why would I want to read it? What's the hook?
The story is about a woman who escapes a group of criminals and decides that, with the help of a retired soldier who's suffering from his own issues, and she decides that the only way to fully escape these criminals is to seek revenge on them. So, you know, if you like Kill Bill, but it didn't go far enough, I think that's sort of...
That's what actually should be on all the promos for this book. If you like Kill Bill, but it didn't go far enough.
If you like Kill Bill, but it didn't go far enough.
And to that point, reading this, wait a minute, I thought she got... No, she didn't get that one yet. We're not giving anything away here, people, and you should read this book, The Unrepentant. But you say irredeemable. I thought it... Without giving anything away, again, very dark for Jeannie because she's a nice person, but I loved it.
No, I'm not a nice person.
I thought it was...
it was still dark.
I thought it was optimistic. I thought at the end they had reasons to live.
Don't give away the end.
I'm not, because some of them didn't. And what you did to Dora, by the way, was just... Come on.
Yeah.
Come on. Man, I had her in my camp.
There's a... Yeah, I think, you know, I don't want to write a book that is depressing, you know, and this is pretty close, I think, but there has to be a sense of optimism. I mean, the reason we read, write is for, you know, a sense of escape. And I think a lot about I think a lot about the show Cheers.
There we go.
Which, yeah,
if you liked Kill Bill and Cheers, then we got the author for you.
Yeah. But there has to be, Cheers had the bar, right? And that's where everybody went for their happy place. I mean, that was the, in Friends, it was the apartment. In
or the Cosby perk.
Yeah, the perk. Or in the Cosby Show, it was, you know, the living room of the house. Certainly not the gynecologist's office downstairs. But we, you know, with books, a lot of times that happy place doesn't necessarily, it's not a place, it's a place between characters. So I felt like for Mace and Charlotte, their happy place that, you know, whether they that they needed to find, they found in each other. And they found, it was important for me not to have any kind of a romantic connection between the two, but just to have a pure friendship.
What allowed them to trust each other? Because they did.
It took a while.
And she's very young. Again, without giving anything away, she's very 18?
18.
18 years old. After what she had gone through, terrible, comes from a terrible family, chased, kidnapped, dragged across the country, subjected to all sorts of horrible things. But what causes her to trust him and vice versa?
They're both running. They're both in the, she's physically running, he's emotionally running. And Mace is running from everything. You know, he's running from everything, but he's in sort of in a hamster's wheel while he's doing it. You know, he's separated, you know, on the verge of divorce or just divorce from his ex-wife, a relationship that he's still in but unable to get fully back in. He's running from his experiences in the war, and that explains his reluctance to engage in violence or his at times refusal to. Mm-hmm. So I think that sense, they both see that sort of kindred spirit in each other.
Mm-hmm. So as a writer, I'm always interested in the process of writing.
Yeah.
So do you know at the beginning of writing this book how it's going to end?
No. Oh, I do, but I'm wrong a lot of times because I like...
Don't you hate it when you fool yourself?
Yeah.
I'm just like, wow.
I don't like being wrong. I usually with my wife, but there's a sense of... I usually have an idea for an ending image, you know, and I don't write poetry, but I read it, and I really like when poems have an unfinished element to their ending. They just sort of... It doesn't fully resolve, and that's kind of the image I have at the end. So this book changed. I had it ending differently, and I guess I can't really talk about that, but it changes as I dramatically plot out everything, and that plot, that outline will change.
So you know when Hollywood gets the rights to the book and they make a movie?
Sure.
Liam Neeson, call your service.
They'll have a different ending. They'll test it. And then what you'll find out is that your ending is no longer in the movie.
Yeah.
That's what happened, by the way, with The Natural. Remember The Natural?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
So he...
Remember Chris Buckley's book, Thank You for Smoking?
Yeah.
It's a fabulous book. Whoever is going to be the screenwriter calls him up to introduce himself and goes, I'm the guy that's going to wreck your book. And Chris says, well, you're paying me a lot of money. That's okay. So we never tell people this before they come on, Ed, but one of the rules with Chatter and Books, when this does get made into a movie or a Netflix series, we get invited to premiere. So with your little fans. Yeah. But who would play Mace? Who would play Charlotte?
Well, Liam Neeson has got to be in here.
Might be too old.
Well, he might be too old.
There's a really creepy story about that, which is for this book, I started to do something different, which is I kept photos of the of what I thought the characters would look like.
Photos of real people in your basement?
Well,
the dark light?
Pinned up on a bulletin board?
Yeah.
Little creepy.
Diagrams.
The really distressing thing is for Charlotte, when I met our nanny's best friend, I was like, oh my gosh, she's exactly what I had in mind for Charlotte. It's
wow.
Crazy. So I had a photo of
might want to get a new nanny.
Not for that reason. I had her photo, you know, along with other photos. And that was a hard conversation to have with my wife.
What is the picture of our nanny's friend doing on this wall?
As far as I know, she doesn't act, so she wouldn't be someone for the movie. But I don't know the actress's name, but the woman, the girl who was in the movie Logan, if you remember that.
Who is it, Marcellus?
Let me find her.
Okay, yeah.
And for the guy I had, I can't remember his name now.
The guy who's the ex-Marine who was in Black Klansman. Come on. He's really cool. He's very tall, long, dark hair.
He plays in Star Wars.
Yes.
Oh, the guy who's...
It's like charades. Everyone's hitting their heads.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, I was actually thinking of the guy who was in New Jack City, and I cannot remember his name, but it was... Because it came out like 91, and it's going to drive me crazy, but I'm going to...
You can check that out.
So, you know, one of the
things... He's available.
I mentioned... I mentioned Lee Childs and Jack Reacher. So, of course, every Jack Reacher fan was disappointed when Tom Cruise was cast.
He's so short.
The character, you know, who's a big guy. But the good news is, apparently, there's now going to be a series. They're redoing it as a series in which they're going to actually be more true to the book. So we're looking forward to that.
Excellent.
Which development company is doing that? But it'll be coming soon to a streaming service near you.
I hope so.
Cool. So, Ed, what's next?
Mario Van Peebles isn't next, but that's the guy I was thinking
about. Oh, good. He can do dark enough? He can do mean enough?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Because Mace had kind of a streak in him.
I think so. I think he can. I mean, I assume. I haven't seen him act in a lot of years.
Yeah.
Mace is kind of a menacing name.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
And it's based, by the way, folks who are listening to this, we're talking to Ed Imar, we're talking about The Unrepentant, which is really, really, I did it in one sitting.
I did it in two settings, and I have to say,
we were texting back and forth.
And I like dark. Yeah.
But it's based in the DMV, which is great. I'm a sucker for anything in the DMV just because I love, I know that neighborhood. I know that street. I know what he's talking about. I love that in Baltimore. Anytime you can say
I've been around long enough to know that it wasn't used to be called the DMV.
Same here.
Maybe the last 5 years.
People thought the DMV. I'm like,
Department of Motor Vehicles.
Half Street. Half Street. It's going to be down there for 3 days getting my car registered. Yeah. Okay. It's fabulous. Ed, thank you for being with us. We're going to take a quick break here, and I did not give you your homework, but you're going to be part of our wrap-up here, in which we're going to do a segment called Deserted Island. It'll be easy. You'll have to think on your feet, but I'm familiar. Do it. So, Marcellus, we'll take a break and come right back. We are back. Chatter on Books. We've been talking to Ed Imar, who has got to get those photos of his nanny's girlfriend off his walls. Just a little career advice, Ed. Yeah. So this is the Deserted Island segment and the never-ending quest to try segments that we may never try again. In this case, I'm going to put you on the spot too, Ed. Jamie and Jeannie and I are going to pick books. And then in a couple of weeks, our soon-to-be new best friend, Chantal Singh, who... I was introduced to via Nevin Martell. Remember Nevin Martell?
Oh, yeah.
DC hotshot, foodie, critic, photographer, everything. He introduced me to her. She is a rock star mixologist. She is a sherry ambassador. I don't know what that means, but we'll ask her when she's on the show in a couple of weeks. And she hosts the Reading Room. That's a thing. It's like a weekend thing in Petworth Citizen. I should know what Petworth Citizen is. Maybe you do it. It's like a cool, hip place. Maybe in Shaw. And there she combines her love for books in the Reading Room with cocktails, and she crafts custom cocktails to go along with literary themes that she's chosen for the weekend. And it sounds fabulous, and we probably should do this show there sometime, but Saturday night, I don't know. So we are going to pick books. I'm going to let her know in a few days, and then when she comes back in a couple of weeks, she will custom make cocktails for these books. So Jeannie, would you like to go first with your pick?
Yeah, my pick is The Great Railway Bazaar by Paul Theroux. This is when he gets on the Orient Express and takes a four-month trip from London to Europe to Mideast to India to Southeast Asia. And on the Trans-Siberian Railway, but I'm not expecting her to, like...
Do you want a little
background?
steam engine puttering around the top of your glass?
There's a moment where Paul Theroux is talking about the various opportunities to eat on this travel. And Chantel, I can't remember exactly where it was. I'll try to help you out on this more specifically later. But there's one point where they're really hungry. And when they pull into a railway station, there are vendors on the tracks offering passengers food through the windows. And Paul Thoreau sees this one vendor stick this delicious-looking kebab through the window. And he
Chantal's going to have to start with a very large glass.
And he, he grabs it. And as he buys it, and it turns out, and I think I believe that it is sparrows that have been speared and grilled and whatever.
I want feathers in my cocktail.
So, I mean, it could be a Cornish hen or a small bird grilled, whatever.
Okay. I'm thinking where Chantel goes is something like an Oscar Wilde drink, which is rose-infused water with flowers on top. But with Jeannie now, we have a 55-gallon drum.
So Chantel, I would just say grilled poultry.
Yeah, nice. Nice. Jamie?
So, you know, as a senior writer for defense and national security for the Washington Examiner and the author of the authoritative Daily on Defense.
Which is really good, and people should read it.
I, of course, have to read a lot of books that are written by, you know, former retired generals. And so on my reading list this recently was, of course, Call Sign Chaos by Jim Mattis.
Which, it's a great title.
Which, by the way, I have to say, I've read a lot of books on leadership by retired military officers that are just painful to get through.
Yeah.
You know, they have, like, advice like, do the right thing, you know,
make your bed.
Yeah. But I actually really enjoyed reading his book. It's full of what I call Mattisisms, little aphorisms that he kind of sprinkles on every page. So I'm picking this book, which I would classify as a nonfiction memoir, as the book that I would like to see a cocktail inspired by. Something that would be, that would rate somebody who also, who said, and I'm going to just quote, I basically, on my, on the Examiner side, I picked what I thought were the 50 best Mattis quotes, and I posted them. He said, if you haven't read hundreds of books, learning from others who went before you, you are functionally illiterate. You can't coach and you can't lead. That's not aimed at anyone in particular. But he also said, and I have the 50 best books on the side. You can go find it if you Google it. He said, I come in peace. I didn't bring artillery, but I'm pleading with you with tears in my eyes. If you F with me, I will kill you all.
Love
it. I'd like to see a cocktail that's both sort of compassionate and pro-reading, and on the other hand, has a plan to kill everybody he meets.
Maybe it lights up or something like that, right? Maybe it's just kind of nice and swirling.
UGER.
Yeah, I like that. Okay, Chantal is going to have her hands full. Ed, do you have one for us? I'm putting you on the spot.
Yeah. I was thinking of a couple, but I think I would go with a writer named Alex Segura, who lives in his last book, particular Miami Midnight, is the end of his detective series. I think it was a 5-book series, and it's based in Miami, and where all the entire series is set. And the book itself has a lot of jazz in it, a lot of Cuban jazz. It takes part of the book goes to Cuba, and I feel like it lends itself, and Alex is such a terrific writer, that it lends itself to a somewhat imaginative cocktail.
And rum. I'm thinking
and
rum.
It's
yeah.
going to be rum. Yeah.
Excellent. I like that one.
It's got mint in it, too. And
yeah. Yeah.
Sort of mojito.
Yeah. Parasols coming out of it. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm not saying what it has to do.
Yeah. I'm going to go with Gone with the Wind. Just because I love the book, I love the movie, but I recently saw the clip when Carol Burnett did her skit about Gone with the Wind on her show.
The drapes.
And if you've got 10 seconds, Google it. It's one of the funniest things ever done on television, which she comes down the stairs of Tara wearing the drapes on her shoulders. And so I'm just hoping Chantal is creative enough and has a team of people working for her enough that there could be little drapes on my drink, which would be great. And I've got to get these from David and from Michael. I might have overextended my best wishes with Chantal, but I'm going to try. So this has been fabulous. Ed, thank you so much for being with us.
Yes, thank you.
Really, really
yes.
cool. Come back. Tell other authors about us. We're fun. We drink, as you can see.
I've been trashed all night.
You can come back anytime you want. Little housekeeping. Please download us, review us nicely. Send us your questions, your comments, your insults, info@chatteronbooks.com. We do read emails. Some of you who send emails every day, we can't read them every day. But Jeannie, we should thank Ed Butt.
Jeannie. All a case of wine, at, not to mention all the ideas Ed
sends. Yeah, really good ideas.
All the whites are for me. The reds are for the rest of you suckers.
Yes, we got it. And the t-shirts. And thank you, Ed. So thanks to Jeannie and Jamie and Roberta. Thank you for being here. Marcellus for doing all the important things. Next week, we are going to be at a remote. We're going to be across the river. Get out your passports, right? And we're going to see our friends at One More Page Books in Arlington. Have you been there, Ed?
I love One More Page.
They are great.
Bookstore.
They are absolutely great. We're going to go there and we're going to have Will Haygood, award-winning journalist who has he actually wrote the story upon which the movie The Butler was based, which he probably doesn't like that reference because he's just written some extraordinary things, including a book called Tigerland, which is this great book about true story, 1960s, Columbus, Ohio, a team, black team that won all the championships despite facing segregation. You have it?
Right on my bedstand. It's about three books down.
We'll read it and then send us some questions. So you could come next week, next Monday. People should be there. It'll be fun. Wonderful people. Thanks, everybody. See you next week.